From KLW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Or Redwood City, California.
Hayward?
Near Richmond District, kind of.
I'm from Concord.
Martinez.
Hercules.
I'm from Marina, California.
SF State, wherever that is.
Coming up, we'll continue our series of conversations about the changing face of local media.
We're endlessly scrambling to keep up with all that's going on because it's a city that punches way above its weight in terms of interesting things going on.
Then we'll find out how one of the cities by the bay got its name.
The university dams up Strawberry Creek, so the wells down in Ocean View begin drying up.
And we'll visit Highland Hospital in Oakland to hear from a healthcare professional who treats the spirit.
It's not the medical treatment, it's the human treatment that should be first and foremost in your mind.
That's all coming up today on Cross Currents. Whether you think Craigslist is killing the daily newspaper or the internet is liberating communication, it's all changing fast. Today, we're going to continue our series on the Bay Area's shifting media landscape, and we're considering the impact of those changes on local media. Lance Noble fashioned his career as a business journalist, mostly in England. When he moved to Berkeley with his British wife about a decade ago, they saw something that bothered them.
We saw that there was a big gap in Berkeley for the provision of news. It was the city we lived in. Nobody was really telling us what was going on in our city.
So they did something about it. Along with another partner, in 2009, they founded Berkeleyside. It's an online news journal all about Berkeley. And they found an audience. Today, Berkeleyside has an average of 140,000 unique visitors a month. It provides content for the San Francisco Chronicle, and through a combination of fundraising and advertising, it's sustainable. KLW's Ben Trefney sat down with Berkeleyside co-founder Lance Noble and asked him what he thinks his audience is looking for.
That's not always easy to answer. Sometimes things surprise us. On some levels, it's the things that audiences all over want to know about. It's
Justin Bieber.
We've had the occasional celebrity news when they were filming Moneyball. The family was staying at the Claremont, and so we had an article about that, which went, you know, viral for a while. But that's incredibly rare for us. I regret to say it, but the last month, for example, has been a very, very good month in terms of readership for us. But it's because Berkeley had some major crimes. You know, when there's a murder or something like that, traffic spikes enormously, and it spikes both because of community interest. You know, people in Berkeley are interested in it, but also major crimes attract readers from outside the city. There is a lot of interest in that, as you know, radio and television news shows. Big crime is something people are interested in, and in a tight community like a city of Berkeley, that's perhaps understandable. I don't think it's purely voyeurism. I mean, people really want to know what's going on. They hear police sirens, or they hear about, there were shots fired, and they want to know about it. And that's huge for readership. With Google Analytics, you can see not just how many people read us yesterday or read us last month. They have a real-time analytics, so you can see how many people are on the site this second. So sometimes, the news just hits you, and it can be a really big thing for the community in terms of people's interest.
That's Lance Noble. He's co-founder of Berkeleyside, which is a news source in the city of Berkeley. Well, other news organizations, it seems, have gone perhaps the route of more entertainment rather than information. What do you think of that in terms of the media landscape overall and the state of how that affects the Bay Area and what people consume here?
I think that's a viable strategy. If you look at something like BuzzFeed, BuzzFeed has become very successful commercially, very, very successful in terms of readership. And it's largely fueled by the so-called listicles, the 10 top, photos of George Clooney you've never seen, the 10 top, whatever it is. But what's really interesting about something like BuzzFeed, and BuzzFeed is not us. I mean, that's not I don't think we've ever even done a listicle, and maybe that's we're at fault for that. But BuzzFeed has real reporting as well, you know, alongside that sort of entertainment and sort of the silliness and also the very viral thing of, oh, did you see this list or isn't that curious? You know, they have real reporters and they do real news, and that seems to be a combination that works for them. So that's one approach. That's not our approach.
Well, the fact that so many people are attracted to listicles and things like that, when you step back away from the daily beast that you have to feed as being a, you know, a news source, what do you think that says about media consumers? Are people creating content that they think people will read because it's going to draw traffic, or are people going there because it's the most entertaining thing? I mean, it seems that maybe there's some sort of an atrophy of taking in information that ultimately is more important than the top 10 photos of George Clooney that you've never seen.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's interesting that's happened with technology and the movement to the web and to mobile is we know a lot more about what people are doing than we could ever have possibly known before. When we read the news in a newspaper, you know, printed paper, the publisher of the New York Times, I mean, they could commission research, what are people really reading, but that was secondhand. They didn't know what most of the people that got their newspaper every day really did. You know, were they reading the story on page 17, or were they reading the front page, or were they just looking at the sports, or was anyone reading the op-eds? You know, you could find out roughly, but you didn't really know. Online, you know everything. You know absolutely everything. How many seconds people are spending reading things, what link they followed to get there, which page they looked at, which pages they didn't look at, you know, pages that they looked at and they immediately bounced away from. And so there is, I think, a danger. It can be very insidious. And there certainly are media organizations in the country that reward their journalists. You know, if you get more page views on your stories, we will give you a bonus. And so that leads to something like, you know, the death of headline writing, because the reality is clever headlines, you know, one remembers the, you know, Variety headline, you know, Hicks, Nicks, Sticks, Flicks, you know, about people in the countryside didn't like movies about the rural areas. So Hicks, Nicks, Sticks, Flicks is a great headline. On the web, it's a terrible headline because for SEO, for search engine optimization, it does nothing. You're much better to have a headline saying rural people don't watch country movies. You know, that's much better for Google. And so there are plenty of media organizations that reward that. I mean, we know about search engine optimization, and we try and, you know, if we're writing about the Berkeley City Council, we try and have Berkeley City Council in the headline. But, you know, we try and have good headlines, too. And we don't reward people on Berkeley side for getting more page views for a story. If somebody writes a great story and it gets very little readership, but it's a great story, we're delighted. And, you know, maybe one day pressures will force us to go another way because, you know, there are, if you get more readers, ultimately you will get more money. But, you know, we've managed to hold the tide against that.
That's Lance Noble. He is the co-founder of Berkeley Side. So are you able to make a living in the other three journalists on the site at this point?
What we've decided to do, you know, in terms of the founders and the owners of the site, is the site has made money consistently, but rather than as owners taking much of that money out of the site, we've used it to hire two sales staff, to hire a reporter. So the founders have made very, very little money out of Berkeley Side as yet. I mean, I have enormous belief that over the long term, it's a sustainable business. It will be a business that does provide for us. But, you know, all of the owners have had to either forego much in earnings or find other ways to make a living while we're kind of getting Berkeley Side to being really sustainable. Because it is a 24/7 thing. The news happens when it happens, and you're just running all the time. I think, you know, we've staffed up to a point where we are running all the time, but it isn't crazy.
That's Berkeleyside co-founder Lance Noble speaking with KALW's Ben Trefney. Berkeleyside is sponsoring a live event this weekend called Uncharted, the Berkeley Festival of Ideas. It's an entire festival of great thinkers, discussions, and workshops at the Berkeley Art Museum, the Berkeley Rep, and the Freight and Salvage. You'll find more about it at KALW.org. Just click on Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Holly Kernan. And as long as we're talking about Berkeley, let's take a minute to explore that name, Berkeley. Why is it called that? Well, that's the kind of thing KALW's Stephen Short explores in our series called The Source. Let's join him.
Berkeley, California has a long-held reputation as a center of free thinking and free speaking, of course, thanks in large part to the university. And Charles Wallenberg, chair of the Social Science Department at Berkeley City College and author of Berkeley, A City in History, says there's another long-standing tradition, the rivalry of town and gown.
The essential fact about the history of the English-speaking community of Berkeley is that it had two beginnings, not one. One of them was a small informal community that grew up in the 1850s called Ocean View, and it was located along the shore of the bay on either side of the mouth of Strawberry Creek.
Can't you just hear the ads? New homes at Ocean View on Strawberry Creek from the low hundreds.
And almost immediately they come into conflict with each other. The university dams up Strawberry Creek, so the wells down in Ocean View begin drying up. The wastewater and the sewage from the university starts flowing down Strawberry Creek into there.
But there's nothing like a common enemy to get people to cooperate. In 1878, that common enemy was the expanding community of Oakland, which was eager to swallow them both.
And so on April 1st, 1878, the two communities of the campus community and Ocean View joined together and were incorporated into the city of Berkeley.
Wait a second. You said April Fool's Day?
April Fool's Day. That's right. Some people think that was a very appropriate day for Berkeley to become incorporated.
Now, it's pretty obvious where they got the name Ocean View. There's no story there. But Berkeley. Remember where we are. This is the late 1800s, and the concept of manifest destiny is shining in America. A poem by Irish Anglican Bishop George Berkeley, Westward the Course of Empire Takes Its Way, is still popular in some circles, even though it's about 150 years old. First, school leaders know of Bishop Berkeley's efforts to provide education and training to colonial children. Then his ideals sum up the goals of their new college overlooking the Pacific, and also the idea
that this is going to be a community with a certain amount of prestige associated with it. It's going to be an educated, upscale community. That's already incorporated into that name, into that choice of that name.
Based on a guy who wore a white wig.
Right, a guy who wore a white wig.
The British pronunciation, Berkeley, was lost over the years as people began pronouncing it closer to the way it's spelled, Berkeley. Now, few in that city today would admit to any association with colonial empire, but don't use 21st century markers to grade Bishop Berkeley's goals for imperialism. Listen to his ideal from about 275 years ago, and you may think softer thoughts of his work. There shall be sung another golden age, the rise of empire and of arts, the good and great inspiring epic rage, the wisest heads and noblest hearts. For KALW News, I'm Stephen Short in Berkeley.
That certain night, the night we met, there was magic abroad in the air. There were angels dining at the Ritz, and a nightingale sang in Berkeley Square.
I may be
You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. And now it's time for your stories from San Francisco StoryCorps.
Hi, I'm Bob Schmidt.
And I'm Minnie Swift.
Hi, my name is Anthony Meredith Piccioni.
I'm at Highland Hospital.
We're at Highland Hospital.
And I'm one of the senior therapists at Highland Hospital.
From time to time, the story team goes mobile and collects interviews at different places around the Bay Area. Today, we're kicking off a series of interviews that took place at Highland Hospital in Oakland. The public hospital has been around since 1927 and has served thousands of patients. Its emergency room is required to take you whether or not you have insurance. And it's also a trauma center, so if you're in a car accident or you've been the victim of violence, that's most likely where you'll end up.
So, go ahead and call it.
Yes.
Time of death?
That is 2016.
You get an age on this kid?
Oh, yeah.
Tanya?
15.
15? Jesus Christ.
The hospital ER is the setting for the documentary film The Waiting Room. Back in 2012, we spoke with the film's director, Pete Nix.
Originally, the film ostensibly was a film about the uninsured. And fairly quickly, we realized that The Waiting Room was just a place where so much manifested in terms of not just the hospital system itself, but our entire society at this moment in time when the economy is pushing people into public hospital waiting rooms that have never been there before. And we realized that it was kind of a universal experience, and we wanted to tell the story in a way that could give additional information to people who thought they knew how hospitals worked. And it's one of those things where you think, oh, this is obvious.
But it's not necessarily that obvious, and it may be even more confusing now that the rollout of the Affordable Care Act has the country in a heated debate over our access to health care. So Nix teamed up with StoryCorps to collect more interviews at Highland and go deeper into the stories of people who depend and work within that public hospital system. Our first interview is between Janae Harper, who goes by the nickname Z, and Benika Curry. Z Harper is a patient care navigator, which means exactly what it says. She helps her patients navigate the ups and downs of the healthcare system and get the treatment they need. She met Benika Curry earlier this year when Benika discovered she had stage 2 breast cancer.
I discovered my lump doing self-exam on myself, July 15, 2012. That's my birthday. The urban community, you're so scared because you're not working. Your husband is the only one working, so you don't want to add to the bills. And I waited 7 months to even go to Highland Hospital, which to me, I think I would have been in stage 0 instead of stage 2. But it was so painful, and I felt it growing. And so what Z did for me is to help me understand that it'll be okay, and that whatever I need, she got me. And she helped me not to feel like I was a burden on my husband, because now that I was trying to find a job, I got breast cancer, I can't work. So Z, what made you want to be a patient care navigator?
I never chose to be a patient care navigator. Actually, I hated hospitals. But then the recession came. I got laid off of my job for 15 years. Prior to this, I worked for a nationally recognized nonprofit. And, you know, basically it was economics. There was a job opening I thought I was qualified for, and I applied for it. But little did I know the privilege it is to work for a hospital. I always thought about sickness in regards to a hospital. I never thought about healing. I never thought about wellness. I never thought about any of it. So I feel like I'm being enlightened and educated. And I have to say that I feel blessed, especially blessed to work for Highland, because I'm an Oakland native. I'm 50 years old and I'm born and raised here at Highland. So I really feel like I'm serving my community. So it's more than a job to me. You know, I personally believe there are professions and there are callings. And I believe that I have been called to serve. Highland used to have a reputation of just being a little raggedy ghetto hospital. And I'm not going to lie, initially, I kind of thought the same thing about Highland before I started working here and really getting to see the commitment that the employees have. I thought the same thing, honey. I thought I was cute. I was a Kaiser patient, and ooh, I'm not going to Highland. Are you kidding me? And now I feel so stupid and elitist because I was completely ignorant. But now I'm like, God is so good. God is so good. And he showed me the error of my ways. And I feel like because of that, I don't want to cry because I don't want to mess up my mascara. But now I feel like, man, how many people have I walked by on the street and judged them? You know, not knowing the backstory. Probably one of the greatest benefits of working here is it keeps me humble. And it keeps me thankful because I see every day how blessed I truly am. And it just makes me that much more determined to be a blessing to somebody else. Patients aren't going to come to chemotherapy and they're trying to keep a roof over their head. Or they're trying to put food in their stomach. Or they have daycare issues. It was just amazing how the order of what's important in the medical field didn't match the order of what's important in your personal life. So through our program, we've been really able to kind of like reprioritize what's really important for the patient in their personal life in order to deal with their health issues. And I'm telling you, Benika, you put a lot of us to shame that actually have this as a job. The way you researched everything, I mean, I could just sit up here and give a testimonial about you all day. I feel so small in your presence because I don't know how you do it.
Yeah, it was rough for me, like, I guess because the way my hair was falling out. But then I promised myself that every time I go to chemo, I'm going to be dressed for success, you know, because that's an accomplishment. Going to this chemo, just trying to still feel like you're human.
You know, some people are coming from, you know, being drug addicted or abusive relationships or just being poverty stricken. They don't really have a will to live. To them, it's like, this is just one more thing.
What I used to say, because that's how I felt, but what I realized is because you are damaged don't mean you cannot be loved.
That's right.
And you have to surround yourself at home, at your hospitals, as far as picking your doctors, mm-hmm. but especially at home, you have to surround yourself by positive people who are going to support you.
Mm-hmm.
And so my breast cancer journey has been awesome, especially having you in my corner. I'm the boxer and you my boxing coach.
Oh, well, go ahead.
And we fighting it.
I love you, Benika, and you're such a blessing to me. Like I said, I'm better because of you.
That's Janae Harper, a patient care navigator at Highland Hospital in Oakland, speaking with her patient, Benika Curry. They spoke with StoryCorps facilitator Geraldine Asu, and their interview was edited by KALW's Martina Castro. You can find more information about StoryCorps at our website. Go to kalw.org. That's also where you can subscribe to the Cross Currents podcast. And that's it for today's Cross Currents from KALW News. Our team includes Hana Baba, Julie Kane, Jen Chien, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Seth Samuel, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Daniel Moore, Alyssa Kapnick, Charlotte Silver, Rebecca Burungi, Jasmine Lopez, and Resu Sussman, along with Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Our senior producer is Martina Castro. Ben Trefney, of course, is our executive editor. And thanks to you, KALW is independent, listener-supported, commercial-free public radio. What you're hearing now is Orquesta Borinquen. They call themselves the Bay Area Salsa Powerhouse Band. You can experience the power tomorrow when Orquesta Borinquen plays the Shadow Ultra Lounge in Oakland starting about 9 p.m. That information along with more local music is at kalw.org. Just click on Cross Currents. For Cross Currents, I am Holly Kernan. Escucha lo que te traigo, que te dice a
sleep.